It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll speak with a Wisconsin Islamic leader about recent comments made by presidential hopeful Ted Cruz about policing Muslim neighborhoods.
But first, the five remaining presidential candidates squared off yesterday in the latest round of primaries and caucuses.
On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders did well in a couple of states participating in Western Tuesday, with Hillary Clinton taking a win in one of those three. And Donald Trump and Ted Cruz are still battling for delegates on the Republican side.
And President Obama made a historic trip to Cuba this week, making him the first sitting president in 88 years to visit the island. The president was in Cuba when news broke that there was a terrorist attack in Brussels. We'll talk about his reaction to those attacks a little bit later.
Joining us now to talk about all of this and more is Harry Enten. He's the senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
So yesterday, voters in three Western states headed to the polls. Idaho, Arizona, and Utah all had Democratic races. Republican voters voted in Arizona and Utah. How do these states compete with other big delegate states in the country?
Well, I mean, none of the results that we saw yesterday were really surprising, right? If we look at the demographics, we look at the polling, everything that we thought about both the Democratic and Republican race is basically the same after last night. So you had Bernie Sanders, who won in Idaho and won in Utah. Those are good delegate prizes for him. But Hillary Clinton won in Arizona. Not a big surprise there. Large Hispanic vote. She tends to do better with states that have large Hispanic or African-American populations. Bernie Sanders gained overall in the delegate count, but Clinton's so far ahead that he really wasn't able to splice into her lead very much. On the Republican side, we had Utah and Arizona. Trump was expected to do well in Arizona. He did. He won all 58 delegates there. Cruz was expected to do very well in Utah. He got well over 50% of the vote, thereby triggering a winner-take-all. He took 40 delegates. No big surprises. It really just sets up what, to me, is potentially the most important primary of the Republican season so far in Wisconsin 2 weeks from now, and we'll see what happens. Though a new poll that just literally came out has Cruz up by a point in Wisconsin, but we'll see when some more reliable polling from Marquette comes out whether Cruz is able to hold on to that edge.
You think Wisconsin is going to be the biggest key to this race so far? Why Wisconsin?
I think so. And the reason that it is, you know, for Donald Trump, the real question is whether Donald Trump gets 1,237 delegates. If he cannot get there, we have a contested convention. And if you have a contested convention, who knows what happens? And Wisconsin is one of those states. We at 538 basically surveyed a whole bunch of experts on how they thought the remaining states would go. And Wisconsin was one of those states where the experts pretty much split, where some of the experts thought it'd be a good state for Trump and a whole bunch of other experts thought it wouldn't be. And any bit that you can get, either Trump doing better than expected or worse than expected, could make or break his chances of getting the 1,237 delegates. And Wisconsin, which has a number of delegates at stake and is a real state where Trump and Cruz should both be competitive. If Cruz overperforms, it would make it much more difficult for Trump to be able to reach that and give Cruz a real shot in a contested convention.
So we've been talking about Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, but Governor John Kasich is still vying for the GOP nomination. He's still hanging in there. He was well behind in Arizona, but technically beat Trump in Utah. You know, what does his game plan need to be at this point?
You know, I really don't know what the heck John Kasich's campaign is doing, to be perfectly honest. You know, I understand Trump insofar as that he's unpredictable. He says things and he throws things against the wall and hopes that the media follows him. But Kasich, for instance, spent over $600,000 in Utah and then comes away with, yes, he beat Trump, but he still comes away with less than 20% of the vote in the state. It made no sense for him to make a play there. I think Kasich could be competitive in some of these northeastern primaries, say New York, say Rhode Island, say Pennsylvania, but he doesn't seem to be making a play there. If I were him, I would be going to New York right now. I'd be, you know, trying to play up, trying to get delegates. If he holds Trump under 50%, either statewide or in congressional districts, Kasich could win delegates. That's where I would be right now, but he's not there. I just don't understand what he's doing, and truthfully, it is a huge mystery to me. Yes, he's still around, but if he's going to these states like Utah and Arizona and not winning delegates, so what if he's on the campaign trail? The name of the game is winning delegates, and he's not doing that.
Is he maybe hoping that if he stays in and stays in the news, stays in front of people's eyes, that if there is some big shakeup at the convention, that maybe that positions him to slide into the nominee position that way?
Yeah, I mean, that's really his only hope. I mean, he's not going to be able to get to 1,237 delegates, and if the Ted Cruz campaign is also being honest with itself, it can't get there. The only person who can get there is Trump. But Ted Cruz would be in a far better position to contest the convention because he would have many more delegates than Kasich would. Kasich's only shot is in a contested convention, but in order to get to a contested convention, you need to be able to hold Trump under 1,237 delegates, and that's why I don't really understand what Kasich is doing by going out to Utah, wasting time there, because the only thing he could have done was kept Cruz under 50% of the vote, which would have allowed Trump to accrue delegates, instead of going to New York, where if he can keep Trump under 50%, he can help take delegates away from Donald Trump and at the same time build up his own delegate total. So, I mean, Kasich is in it, obviously, for a contested convention, but I'm just not sure what he's doing is necessarily helpful in ensuring a contested convention takes place.
We're talking national politics right now with 538's Harry Enten. And Harry, it sounds like, at least on the GOP side of things, we won't really have a party winner. We might not have a party winner until June. Seems like a long ways off, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, look, this Republican race is not going to truly be settled for a while. We won't really know whether Trump gets to 1,237 delegates until June 7th. I mean, again, going back to that panel that we did at 538, all of the experts agreed upon that. That's the day when California votes, and that's such a key primary with 172 delegates that are at stake. If Donald Trump does really well there, then it could really help him get to that 1,237 delegates. But if he doesn't, it will really hurt him. But it's still over 2 months away. California is a very interesting race, but we really won't know what goes on for a while. So I guess either buckle up and enjoy the ride, or maybe go and enjoy the sunshine or the blizzard if you're in Green Bay.
What does that do to the race if, you know, there aren't winners till so late in the game? How does that shape, you know, the way they can campaign and not really going at each other, Democrats or Republicans, until June?
Well, I think it probably hurts the Republicans. I mean, it did not keep Barack Obama from doing very well in the 2008 race, despite that race going on for a while. But it was far clearer at this point that Obama was almost certainly going to be the nominee because of the way delegates are proportioned on the Democratic side. But on the Republican side, it just means that the two or three candidates are really just going to go after one another, and they're going to have to stay concentrated on the primary. You're going to have a divided Republican Party. And at the same time, when you have President Obama's approval rating going up, and Clinton, although she's still competing with Sanders, is very close to being the inevitable nominee, she'll be in a far better position than the Republicans will be.
So, as you said, Hillary Clinton won in Arizona last night. In her victory speech, she took an approach similar to her rival, Bernie Sanders. She spoke about people's fears and frustrations with life in the U.S. and the apathy that many people feel during this election cycle. Here's what she had to say.
When we see people running to be president of the United States who are literally inciting bigotry and violence, it's easy to say, you know, I'm not even going to pay attention to that. But what I want you to know is we've got to reclaim the promise of America for all of our people, every single one of them.
So do you see Hillary Clinton ramping up her passion and her rhetoric to appeal to voters who might still be waffling between her and Sanders, or Sanders supporters who she's hoping to bring into the fold?
I mean, obviously she would like to win more primaries than not going forward, but I think her team looks at the delegate math and understands what really is the main priority at this point is when she wraps up the Democratic nomination, she wants to bring those Sanders supporters into the fold. And I think, you know, you can listen to Hillary Clinton, and that's one thing, but you can also listen to Elizabeth Warren, who hasn't endorsed anybody in the primary, and she took to Twitter and did a whole tweet storm against Donald Trump, basically saying that Democrats need to come together. And I mean, look, primary politics can be bloody, they can be tough, they can be difficult, but at the end of the day, Bernie Sanders supporters, for the most part, now there's some who don't, but for the most part have a lot more in common with Hillary Clinton than they do with Donald Trump. And I think Hillary Clinton would be wise to make sure that she doesn't alienate them, and I think that's what she's kind of been doing the past few days and weeks.
Switching gears now, President Obama on a historic visit to Cuba this week, and a lot going on this week outside of that visit. There have been the primaries and the attacks in Brussels. What has the political response been to that visit?
I mean, the response is what you'd basically expect, right? I think a lot of Republicans who don't like this idea of normalizing relationships with Cuba don't really like what he's doing. And when he's at a baseball game and there's the attack in Brussels, they'll obviously attack him over that. But most Americans are, for the most part, perfectly fine with normalizing relationships with Cuba. And they recognize that the president is doing what he needs to be doing, and that there was no real reason for him to necessarily rush back, although Republican presidential candidates like John Kasich certainly took pot shots at Obama, which is basically to be expected.
Well, and in an interview with ESPN, President Obama did defend his decision to stay in Cuba after news of Brussels. Here's what he had to say.
It's always a challenge when you have a terrorist attack anywhere in the world, particularly in this age of 24/7 news coverage. You want to be respectful and understand the gravity of the situation. But the whole premise of terrorism is to try to disrupt people's ordinary lives.
So, Harry, do you think that President Obama is going to have any lasting fallout from staying in Cuba, or is this just going to get buried by the next presidential candidate comments that get blown out in the media?
I think that there's not going to be any lasting sort of impacts from it at all. I mean, most Americans were not watching that interview. I happen to be because I love baseball. But I think that most Americans are just – they recognize that, look, the president is a person. The president should, you know, keep doing what he's doing. If there was an attack on our land, that would be something different. But remember, you go back to when George W. Bush was president and, you know, it was after the 9/11 attacks and he was playing golf and, you know, he says, we must, you know, get those terrorist killers. Now watch me hit this drive. And then he took a shot from with his golf club. I mean, this is what normally happens, right? And I think Americans recognize that and they're not going to hold it against him.
And, Harry, based on where you're sitting, have you seen any sort of effect of the Brussels attacks on the presidential race so far?
I mean, you see it in the rhetoric from the candidates, right? We don't have any polling yet, but if you go back, for instance, to the San Bernardino attacks, you saw the same thing with Donald Trump, you know, hyping up all this anti-immigration rhetoric. And you also saw Ted Cruz kind of taking a part in that, too. Maybe not nearly as harsh as Donald Trump, but fairly close to it. That's the type of thing that we would expect to happen. Whether or not that has an impact on the polling numbers, we don't know yet. But the last time it did, that we had the San Bernardino attacks, in fact, we did see a slight rise in Donald Trump's polling. So it'll be interesting to see if that occurs. But for now, all we've really seen is just that the rhetoric has certainly been ramped up a step or two by the Republicans.
And wrapping up, Harry, going back to Cuba, President Obama is in his final year of office. Do you think this trip and what might lead to normalized relations with Cuba will factor into his presidential legacy?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is what the president's been doing. He has been laying the groundwork throughout these final few years in trying to ensure that he has left behind a legacy that not only is memorable, but one that it can be proud of. And if you look at the polling, most Americans agree with his decision on Cuba. But it'll be interesting to see as the years kind of go on how Americans exactly view it.
Harry, thanks a lot. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Harry Enten is a senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week to talk about politics. Following ISIS attacks in Brussels yesterday, Republican candidate Ted Cruz said that law enforcement needs to be empowered to, quote, patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods before they become radicalized.
Cruz also criticized the New York Police Department, which agreed to settle federal lawsuits that claimed Muslims had been under baseless surveillance and investigation because of their religion. And his comments have gotten criticism and condemnation from Muslims and advocacy groups around the country. He defended his comments later in a conversation with Anderson Cooper, saying radical Islamic terrorism should be patrolled like any other criminal activity.
If you have a neighborhood where there is a high level of gang activity, the way to prevent it is you increase the law enforcement presence there and you target the gang members to get them off the street.
But you're talking about Muslim neighborhoods, not radicals particularly.
I am talking about any area where there is a higher incidence of radical Islamic terrorism.
Joining us now is a member of Wisconsin's Muslim American community, Ibrahim El-Kuda, who is president of the Islamic Center of the Twin Ports. Ibrahim, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you.
Well, what was your reaction when you heard about Ted Cruz's comments calling for so-called Muslim neighborhoods to be policed and secured?
Oh, you know what? I was just completely disappointed and just saddened by his remarks, and I was completely shocked. I mean, this came from somebody who was running for the highest office here in the country. It was very disturbing, completely irresponsible.
And we heard him clarifying his position, which he continued to do after that exchange, saying that not all Muslims should be patrolled, but that radical Muslim jihadists should be watched. Does that clarification change anything for you?
I don't believe it did. I don't believe it did at all. I think it was just mostly just a reaction just to make it sound better. But in reality, it can't get any better. He's equating a gangster to the normal Muslim American to a potential gangster. And that's just not fair. That comparison is completely not fair.
And what kind of reaction have you seen in the Twin Ports communities about those remarks?
Just like my own reaction, everybody is kind of disappointed. A lot of people are shocked and asking me, it's like, what should we do? How could we actually, what can we do about this? And we're trying to reach out. We're trying just to kind of explain that this does not represent our American values. This person, individual, I mean, I'm talking about the Cruz himself, he only represents himself, and we can't accept the idea that he represents a whole lot of or majority of Americans who actually endorse him. So we're just taking it on him right now, because otherwise it's just such a sad thing, really, to believe that somebody in this day and age has these kind of views.
Now, in New York City, some officials there, where a similar program as Ted Cruz was describing there, some officials pointed out that there were over 1,000 Muslims on the city police force, so differentiating between Muslims and police doesn't make any sense. Is that also true in the Twin Ports?
It is definitely true. It's definitely true. I mean, there's no. It's not any different. Not just here. I mean, wherever you go in the country, there should be no difference. We American Muslims, we just happen to be Muslims, but we are Americans. We stand for our values. We are soldiers. We're in the police force. We are in the private sector. We are businessmen. We are doctors, engineers. So that kind of view is just nothing but segregation and dividing people based on their faith, which is just a dangerous route overall. Just to head down that route, it's just dangerous.
How would you describe what the Islamic Center's relationship is with the local non-Muslim community?
You know what? I would say it's just a wonderful relationship. And recently we've been making a lot of progress as far as opening the doors. And the doors are always open for anybody just to come in, swing by and ask a question, have a meal. No question is a bad question, so don't be embarrassed or shy about asking. We're going and sharing our views and exchanging views and visits with the local churches, synagogues, universities, colleges, any educational institutions. So we're definitely getting involved with as many people in our local community as possible. So we're taking advantage of every opportunity that opens up just to kind of talk to people and be open about views.
Now, Superior and Duluth, they were in the public eye when the mayor called Obama a Muslim who he said was destroying the fabric of democracy. What was the community response then and since?
At first, it was very shocking and kind of scary because, local events get more attention than probably outside the community events. But because it was local, everybody was kind of not just shocked but scared. It's like, what's going to happen to me as a Muslim living here? How is my neighbor going to perceive me? How is my friend going to treat me from now on? How is my professor going to these things? So it was kind of a hands-on experience. And everybody was like, what do we do right now? How do we respond? And then we went to just the basic common sense in Islam, just the very basic teachings of Islam. And it said, just calm people down. Let them come and share a meal with us. And this way, you kind of get rid of any misunderstanding, if there's any, which we did. We invited the mayor over for dinner at our own congregation. And he came, and we invited the city councilors. They sat down with the people. They actually face-to-face. And they started talking, asking questions, getting to know each other. And then guess what? At the end of the day, of the night, they were talking about recipes and making food. And that's what it's all about. So I think it was a very extremely successful event.
So you had some sit-down time together. In terms of the larger community, is there any particular way that you talked to the community at large when tensions were high like that?
Yes, when talking to non-Muslims, we cannot just use the Quran as a reference. We tell them, come on over and meet the people, because those are the people who actually, they're doctors. That's the doctor that you see at the hospital when you go to the hospital. That's the professor who teaches you in at the college. He's the person where you buy things from the store. Muslims are not different. They just have a certain set of values. Not that different from, not far off from like the Christian values or the Jewish values, or so they're not that different. So all you need to do, from my experience, is just what we do is pull people together, bring them together and closer, and say, just try to check it out, see what those guys believe in. And then it works. Once people kind of pass that stage, they calm down and they're like, oh, you know what, this is not any different than myself. And then they establish friendship and common understanding.
Ibrahim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Have a good day.
That was Ibrahim Al-Quda, president of the Islamic Center of the Twin Ports. Women run for office at lower rates than their male counterparts. A new research done by UW Extension looks at what holds women back from running for public office. While anyone considering becoming a candidate may face some obstacles, the study found that men and women cite different concerns.
Joining us now to discuss the study are two of the researchers. Jenny Erickson is an associate professor and community resource development educator with the University of Wisconsin Extension in Sauk County. Jenny, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Victoria Solomon is the Community Resource Development Educator with the University of Wisconsin Extension in Greene County. Her educational programming focuses on leadership development and local government issues. Victoria, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks.
So in an article that you wrote for the League of Wisconsin Municipalities publication called The Municipality, you wrote that while participation in our modern democracy is now open to all citizens, open doesn't necessarily mean that all feel that they can participate as fully. Jenny, what did you mean by that?
Well, Victoria and I spend a lot of time working with local government officials throughout our respective communities, and we just noticed that women just aren't represented at the same levels of men as men. On county boards, about 19% of typical county board makeup is comprised of women, and town boards is even less. It's less than 10%. And so, you know, we were curious as to what was causing that.
And Victoria, how significant is the difference in how many women run for elected office compared to men?
Well, it's very different. I mean, what was actually very interesting as we were looking into this was that when women actually do run, they get elected at the same rate as men do. So really it comes down to why aren't women actually taking initiative and the effort to run.
And do you have any sense of whether that number has changed significantly over the past few decades? Are more women running than used to, or has it always been about the same number?
Well, when it comes down to the county board, there hasn't been that much of a change over the last 10 years. So there hasn't been much movement in that local level there.
So you recently took on a research project along with the University of Wisconsin River Falls Survey Center to look at why women run for public office less than men do. And Jenny, who did you specifically talk to?
We did two different surveys. We surveyed all of the current county board supervisors throughout the state of Wisconsin, and we also tried to survey what we call as potential local elected officials, which are much harder to find. But we used our networks throughout the county, through our various extension offices and their connections to identify folks that might be potential elected officials. And so we were able to compare some of the information between our current county board supervisors and some folks that folks felt were good candidates to run for office.
So I think it's interesting because obviously it's a big decision to run for elected office, whether you're a man or a woman, depending on your own, you know, family situation and other considerations. But you found that women give quite different reasons than men for why they don't run. Victoria, what were some of the top considerations or concerns that women cited?
Well, the top one across the board came down to a lack of time. But one of the things that we noticed for the reasons that women were giving were different issues that sort of boiled down to sort of a lack of confidence and a lack of comfort with different things people were associating with either running for office or for actually serving in office. So that sort of boiled down to sort of a lack of interest or willingness to ask for campaign funds, concerns about potentially negative political atmosphere in local government, and concerns about criticism for either the person themselves or possibly against, you know, their spouse or partner or family.
I found that interesting because according to your research, almost twice as many women than men said that they had concerns about reprisals or criticism. Why do you think that is so much larger a concern for women than male counterparts might feel?
You know, I'm not sure we have a good answer to that. There's so much more research we could be doing, and those are some of the questions that we're kind of starting to uncover. We just know we asked about 30 different barriers, and we know that women rank 25 of those as more significant than men. And so even though they may not necessarily be a lot more significant in the eyes of women than men, there are still 25 of those barriers that are a bigger deal to women. So I think sometimes when you add up all of those barriers, it's kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, death by a thousand cuts. It's just, it gets to be too many to overcome. And together, the sum of the barriers starts to be kind of overwhelming.
One of the things that really stood out to me is that only 5.9% of men said that they don't want to run against an incumbent, while 23.9% of women cited that as a factor for why they wouldn't run. And I have to say, having done early voting and seeing here in Madison three uncontested school board races, for example, it seems like if women are really hesitant to run against an incumbent, that could really contribute to a lot of uncontested races. Jenny?
Yeah, I would agree. I think that, again, what Victoria was talking about is we noticed this significant thread in women's responses around this kind of concept of self-confidence. And that one is ties right into that idea that women are just more hesitant to run against an incumbent. And I think that that's connected with those issues about, this willingness to run and being concerned about making decisions in public. All those pieces are to me, make up that larger component of just not having maybe the confidence that they need or could have to run for elected office.
We're talking with Jenny Erickson and Victoria Solomon right now. They're with UW Extension, and they are working on research to determine why fewer women run for public office than men do. And you know, one of the questions you asked, which I found really interesting, is asking men and women to define what makes someone a qualified candidate. And Victoria, what did you find when you posed that question?
Yeah, so one of the things that was really interesting in looking at that, I just want to mention, is that a number of the people who were responding actually said that they had a lot of the experiences that they were looking at. So we had just been talking about, you know, potential lack of confidence, but people who were responding were actually saying, women who were responding were saying that they had some of the experiences. So that was sort of an interesting finding. One of the first things that really came up was, of course, knowing about local issues and being familiar with the community. And so that was a really, really key piece, the sort of fundamental. Jenny, did you want to talk a little bit more about some of the others?
Sure. Well, we looked at what are some of the skills or experiences people would need to have or to be qualified to run for office. And it was kind of interesting to me that the supervisors, the current county board supervisors, and the potential elected officials in both surveys all agreed on the top five skills or qualities, one being informed on local public policy issues, two, knowing many people in the community, three, attending local government meetings, four, having public speaking experience, and five, running an organization or business. So everyone agreed that those were the top skills that a local elected official should have. And when we asked folks, you know, do you have these experiences? And many of the current elected officials and many of the potential elected officials had all of them. And men and women didn't have a difference in terms of their experiences in that area. But when we asked them, men and women, are you qualified to run? These are the potential elected officials. Overwhelmingly, men said yes, and women, well, I didn't say no, but I would say 60% of women said yes and 71% of men said yes. So we really saw a significant difference in the responses between men and women about how qualified are you to run, even though they had very similar experiences.
And in just about 15 seconds, can we change these? Can we make it easier for women to run?
I think the key piece is asking them to run. We know that people run for office because somebody asked them to run. And women might have a different path to office than men, and so you might need to highlight different pieces. You might need to highlight their current skills and abilities so that they realize, yeah, we've got this. We can run for office too.
Jenny, Victoria, thanks so much for joining us. Jenny Erickson and Victoria Solomon are both with UW Extension and researched barriers for women to run for elected office.
You might not know it, but almost every state in the country has an official state fossil. Coming up, we'll hear some of those stories.
And here in Wisconsin, our official fossil is the trilobite. Other states have specific dinosaur or plant species on the books as their official fossils. Ed Young recently wrote a piece about how states got their fossils for The Atlantic.
Ed Young joins us now. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, where he covers science. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So a lot of people probably don't even know that we have state fossils. What's the idea behind picking one?
Right, so I didn't really know about state fossils until I wrote a story that involved Illinois' choice quite recently. And then I realized that most states do have some kind of ancient plant or animal as their state avatar, and a lot of the choices are really cool, and they sort of resemble, they reflect a lot of interesting things about paleontology, especially the fact that people are just generally interested in it. So a lot of the choices come from like school kids or like local geologists or sometimes even teachers or politicians who have campaigned for a specific species to be named as their state fossil.
Well, I don't know if Wisconsin's counts as really cool or not, but tell us about Wisconsin's pick.
Yeah, so Wisconsin's got quite an interesting choice. It's picked a trilobite, which is one of a very extremely successful group of animals that lived in the oceans between 250 and 500 million years ago. So they're not around anymore, but they were around for a very long time. They were related to insects and crustaceans, and they looked a little bit like wood lice. They came in a lot of different shapes and sizes, and there were thousands of species. Now, I mean, to me, that means that if you pick trilobite as your state fossil, that's a bit like picking dinosaur. It's a bit weird, but fortunately, Wisconsin chose one particular species called, and I'll probably mispronounce this, Calimene celebra. Which was an animal that was actually discovered in Wisconsin in the 1830s and was very common in that state and a couple around it. It was a couple of inches long. As I said, it looked a bit like a woodlouse. It could probably roll up into a ball for defense. It lived in the ocean. So the interesting thing about this is that when it was around, say, like 400, 450 million years ago, what is now North America was isolated as a continent, and what is now Wisconsin was pretty much bang on the equator and surrounded by coral reefs. So it had all this marine life around it, including this particular trilobite.
And we're not the only state to have chosen a trilobite. It sounds like there are others. Can you tell us about some of the other trilobite-loving states?
Right. Ohio and Pennsylvania have also picked trilobites. California almost did. So they had a Wisconsin actually had a choice between a trilobite and the mastodon, which is a large mammoth-like animal, an extinct relative of elephants. So a very giant, impressive beast. And I think it's pretty cool that Wisconsin went instead for the humble trilobite, which is less perhaps less charismatic, but very successful and certainly much older. California had a very similar decision. It was choosing between a trilobite and the saber-toothed cat Smilodon, both of which were were common in California. Both were backed by rival politicians, and in a very California way, they chose the cat with the huge, scary teeth over the humbler woodlouse-looking thing. But Wisconsin didn't. Wisconsin went with the trilobite, which makes me very happy.
Well, I guess the nice thing about having trilobite as a state fossil, you know, for instance, our executive producer, Judith, has a trilobite fossil on her desk. No one could do that in Wisconsin if we picked mastodon.
Oh, right, yeah. You're not just going to find, like, a mastodon buried in your backyard. True. That particular one, the Calimini, is actually, it turns out to be pretty common. So lots of fossils of it have been found in Wisconsin, which does make it a very nice choice.
We're talking with Ed Yong right now, staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers science, and he recently wrote a piece about state fossils. And so Wisconsin's got this trilobite, which is similar to a woodlouse, a little bit, it's maybe a couple inches long. Other states have some pretty cool stuff. I love the choice of West Virginia. It's a giant sloth.
Right, yeah. This creature, the giant ground sloth, modern sloths hang pretty sedately from trees. They're sort of medium-sized. But in in prehistory, there were much bigger versions that lived on the ground and sort of ambled about eating plants. So that's West Virginia's pick. There are loads of other really wonderful, charismatic examples. So some famous one, a Stegosaurus, that dinosaur with the plates on its back and the spikes on its tail, that's Colorado's pick. South Dakota and Wyoming have Triceratops, a very famous dinosaur with three horns on its faces. Utah has Allosaurus, which was a meat-eating dinosaur from the Jurassic period, a kind of precursor to T-Rex. And many states have gone from woolly mammoths or mastodons. So there is no shortage of amazing prehistoric life, and many of them have ended up as state fossils.
And I understand Vermont has a fossil that the only state with an animal that's still living is its fossil.
Right, so it picked a white beluga whale. So belugas are obviously still alive, but they've been around for a long time, so fossils do exist. And one of them was found by railroad workers in 1849 in Vermont. And it was called, it came to be known as Charlotte. That's quite a cute story, but also the fact that Charlotte was found in this field that was some 200 miles away from the nearest ocean and separated by a couple of mountain ranges, it helped to show people that New England was once covered in glaciers, and that when those retreated, the area was flooded by the Atlantic Ocean, which allowed things like whales to live there. So that fossil was part of history. It helped to reshape our understanding of geology. So I think it's a pretty cool choice for a state fossil. It's part of our understanding of the world around us.
And has the choice of state fossil, has it ever been contentious, maybe between creationists and people who believe in evolution?
Yeah, very much so. So one of the latest fossils to be inaugurated is the Columbia Mammoth for South Carolina. So that choice started because a young schoolgirl named Olivia McConnell was dismayed to learn that her home state didn't have an official fossil. So she wrote to lawmakers suggesting the Columbia mammoth as would be as a good choice. And a bill was proposed, but it was delayed by several months because a couple of creationist senators didn't like it. They wanted to include words suggesting that the mammoth had been created, and that referred and words that referred to the Book of Genesis particularly. But that only led to delays, and the bill was eventually passed in May of 2014. So the Columbia mammoth is in fact South Carolina's South Carolina state fossil, despite the best efforts of creationists.
Now, I don't know how familiar you are with fossil hunting in Wisconsin. We've got the trilobite, which is essentially a sea bug. Is it possible? Are they plentiful enough that people are still finding lots of them in Wisconsin?
Oh, I'm sure that's the case. And, you know, the amateur fossil hunting is you know, very much part of the culture. And it's part of the culture that's recognized in the choice of state fossils, too. You know, a lot of these picks have come from people who are amateurs and people who are part of geological societies or people who, like the young girl in South Carolina, were just really enthusiastic about fossils and really wanted to have some kind of official recognition for them. And these things, the fact that we can still find these remains of organisms that lived millions of years ago and had very different bodies and lifestyles to what we know about today, I think is endlessly captivating.
Ed, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Ed Yong, staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers science. He talked about how the states got their official fossils and specifically why the trilobite is Wisconsin's state fossil.
It's March 23rd, and that means it's National Puppy Day. It's the 10th anniversary of the celebration, but really, isn't every day Puppy Day?
It really should be Puppy Day every day, I would say. And the National Puppy Day website suggests celebrating the day with a puppy party, taking your puppy to the beach, maybe not in Wisconsin so much today, or maybe the dog park there, maybe having a portrait painted of your puppy to, quote, suspend the fleeting magic of puppydom.
But there is more to the day than just rolling around on the floor with a little ball of fluff. Organizers hope that it will also be a reminder to adopt from shelters because of the poor puppy mill conditions that some pets are raised in.
And, you know, Charles M. Schulz, creator of Peanuts, he had it right. He said, happiness is a warm puppy. I think that's right. There's so much bad news in the world. Puppies just might help make it a little more bearable.
And I have to say, I am definitely a cat person, but who can resist one of those round little puppy tummies, you know, wriggling around? I could go for a little puppy cuddling.
We've already got a couple of puppy pictures on the Central Time Facebook page. You can post yours. Barr posted a picture of her pup, Clarence, and Sarah Jean posted a pic of her Bichon Frise Poodle Mix.
And we'd love to see your pictures on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going out with a little bit of puppy music.
Puppies, a little baby dog.